I'm really pleased to welcome a former colleague and a close friend to the Bush School this evening. Professor Gregory, you may have read, he's authored something like 12 books and over 100 articles. He is one of the, probably the most well-known expert on the Soviet economy, and then with the demise of the Soviet Union, he became the expert on transition economics, and he is very much an important player. He is a chair professor at the University of Houston, where he and I were faculty members many years ago, before I got lured to A&M. But Paul is also spends most of his time at the Hoover Institute, where he's a research fellow at the Hoover Institution. Professor Gregory, for those of you that aspire to live an academic life, Professor Gregory is the ultimate. He knows kind of where to spend his time. And I have visited Paul in Hawaii, where he was affiliated with the East-West Institute. I visited him also in Davos, Switzerland, where he managed to have some type of arrangement there. And then again in Berlin at the Free University of Berlin, where he was a visiting professor and today holds an associated research arrangement with one of the other universities there. So he knows where to travel, and he knows he manages to live well. And so
on little money.
I don't know. Davos, Switzerland, you know, I'm not going to buy that, folks. So in any event, he's going to talk to us tonight about an issue that as I as an economist am particularly interested in, the issue of sanctions. Because the received wisdom among economists is that sanctions don't work. The free market is so flexible that people find a way around sanctions, and therefore, why bother? And I think this is a terribly important issue because sanctions have been applied against Russia. They've also been applied against Iran. And Iran, of course, is saying, let's release these sanctions. They're acting like the sanctions really matter. But I want to hear from somebody that that has studied this. And so, Paul, I'm going to turn this over to you. We're going to have about 30 minutes for his talk, and then he and I'll sit here. I'll kind of entertain questions from you. We got a real small group tonight, but that's good because you can ask questions and we can have a dialogue. So I'm really looking forward to that. And so, Professor Gregory.
Thank you, Jim.
So, Jim, you go to this mic.
Yeah.
So, Jim has indicated his wisdom by the fact that he has learned to follow me around. But he has not visited me in Palo Alto yet, so that's has to be.
This summer.
Okay, that'll be this summer. This is the title of my talk. I'm going to make it much more informal than I had originally planned. One reason for this is that I prepared some PowerPoints, and I taught a class this morning, and I presented the PowerPoints, and the lecture was rather dreadfully boring. So I think I'll operate on a much more informal level. I am pleased that the crowd is small, and I will try to make this as brief as possible because I'm much more interested in the discussion that follows and in the actual presentation. So if you could turn this off, I'll go back to the screen when I have some charts that I think are interesting to look at. As advertised, this paper is about the effect of low energy prices and sanctions on the Russian economy and hence on the behavior of the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, and perhaps as a constraint on Russia's foreign policy. So it's a rather difficult task to disentangle the effects of the sanctions from the effects of the collapse of oil prices. I can't do it very well, but I think you can sort of distinguish the two. Now, if you ask the Russians about this, and there is a Russian propaganda campaign that is underway, the word you would get is the sanctions are a laughing matter. They really have not hurt us. If they've hurt anyone, it's the businesses in Europe, in Germany, in France, Italy, who do business with us. We have built up these huge reserves in the form of central bank reserves, in the form of rainy day funds, so we can weather this. You're only hurting yourself. Do away with the sanctions. It'll be good for you. We don't mind if you remove the sanctions. I must say as well that the sanctions from the West are very tenuous because there are great differences of opinion among the European powers about these sanctions. The further south you go in Europe, the more opposition you get to the sanctions, and then you have opposition to sanctions in rather unusual places, like former satellites of the Soviet Union. So, I will talk about sanctions, but I think and about the effect of low energy prices. But first, I think it's important to set the setting for the sanctions. You may recall that the sanctions came in three waves. The first wave was with the annexation of Crimea, which was in April of 2014, as I recall. The second came after the shooting down of the Malaysian airline, Flight 17, that was in July. And the third set came in August of 2014 after regular Russian forces invaded Ukraine. When I say that, will be heatedly disputed by Russian propaganda because the official Soviet Russian line is there are no regular Russian troops anywhere in East Ukraine. There may be Russians there, they may be Russian soldiers, they may be wearing Russian uniforms without insignias, but if they're there, they're there because they have volunteered to fight in East Ukraine, and many of them, in fact, are in East Ukraine on vacation. And it's an unfortunate way to lose your life on vacation in East Ukraine. So this is one of the most sensitive issues in Russia today, which is concealing the fact that there have been substantial casualties as a result of the war in East Ukraine, and one of the few organizations that the Russian government cannot shut up are these societies of mothers of Russian soldiers. So they led the movement against the Afghanistan war, and if the casualties continue, they will be a potent force for Putin to keep quiet. So that's how the sanctions came about. And note that in order to get the sanctions approved by this unruly coalition of Europeans and the United States and Canada and Australia, something dramatic had to happen. Even the annexation of Crimea elicited very mild sanctions against Russia. We should not forget the enormous significance of that annexation, because this was the first change by force of national boundaries of the post-war period, if we speak about the Western world. The peace that we've experienced since the end of World War II has really been based on the notion of the fixity of national boundaries. So the annexation of Crimea was not small potatoes in the course of world history. So that elicited very mild sanctions. We would probably not have the sanctions in place today were it not for the fact that a Russian Buk missile crew happened to shoot down a Malaysian passenger jet. And there is all kinds of evidence as to how this was done, and the Russian media continues to deny this. The third shock that caused sanctions to be increased was the invasion by regular forces of East Ukraine in August. And this invasion was ordered by Russia because the Ukrainian forces, even though they're quite weak and poorly organized, were on the verge of defeating the so-called separatist forces. And the fact that Putin ordered the regular Russian army in to prevent the defeat of these separatists tells us how seriously he takes this matter and underscores the fact that he's not going to give in easily. So that's really the setting. And let me explain where we are right now. We have these three sets of sanctions in place. We have the Russian narrative that the sanctions are not much of a bother. They're more of a cost to those introducing the sanctions and to Russia. We still have, Ukraine has yet to receive serious deliveries of lethal weapons from any Western power, even though the U.S. Senate appears to be strongly behind such a move, but the president does not seem terribly interested, and I would be quite surprised if the U.S. delivers weapons before the end of Obama's term. We have two so-called People's Republics, the People's Republic of Donetsk and the People's Republic of Luhansk, which are firmly under rebel control, which means firmly under Moscow control. And we now are in the third or fourth month of what is called the Minsk II Peace Accord, during which hostilities have diminished somewhat. There's still fighting going on a daily basis. I believe yesterday something like 10 Ukrainian soldiers were killed. So on a daily basis there are casualties, even though we are supposedly in this period of peace. Putin is now deciding what to do next. The sanctions may affect his decision, because if he now proceeds further to build this so-called land bridge to the Crimea, which would involve attacking the port city of Mariupol and other towns and villages along the way, he understands if he does this, this will mean a prolongation and perhaps a deepening of sanctions. So we really don't know what's going to happen now. He might work on this land bridge. There's concern that he will perhaps conduct hybrid warfare in the Baltic states. He is currently saber rattling with nuclear weapons, hoping that this will intimidate the West. So we're in this period of waiting right now. We really don't know what's going to happen. If you look at the Western view of things, you primarily hear the following, and that is that we must resolve this through peaceful means. This is a prominent theme of Angela Merkel in Germany. It's a prominent theme of President Obama. It's a prominent theme of Hollande in France. So somehow the West hopes that we can find a peaceful solution to this conflict. I personally do not really see how a peaceful resolution can come about. Therefore, we have a real stalemate problem. And let me explain why. Because Putin, from the very beginning, has outlined his terms for peace. And his term for peace is something he calls federalization. It took the Europeans a while to figure out what federalization means. Merkel took a while to figure it out as well, because she heads the Federal Republic of Germany. And so federal sounds fine, but what Putin means by federalization is that the People's Republic of Donetsk and Luhansk become a part of a unitary Ukraine with the authority and power to veto any major policy undertaken in Kiev. Which means if this were accepted, there would no longer be any Ukraine. Ukraine would cease to exist, because if Texas could tell Washington what it can or cannot do, the United States would cease to exist at that point. I haven't got to sanctions yet, which is what Jim is expecting to hear. So let me take a look at the sanctions. And as I say, one of the problems is that we're trying to sort out the effect of sanctions from the effect of collapsing energy prices, which means two things are going on at once, so it becomes somewhat unclear. We do have an advantage, which is rather rare in history and in economic history, of two events which are very similar. And those two events which are very similar are the financial crisis of 2008-2009, which hit Russia along with other countries. It hit Russia a little harder than other countries. And now we have the current situation of low energy prices and sanctions. And let me explain why the two events are quite simple, quite similar. The major effect, if you look at the sanctions program of the United States and Europe, they consist of three parts. Part number one is that certain individuals lose the privilege or ability to hold assets and bank accounts abroad. They are restricted in their travel. and so on. These sanctions apply to Putin's inner circle. They apply to officers who are active in East Ukraine, politicians who are active in Crimea, and so on. We have really not made much use of that part, although I think this would be very effective, because if Putin's inner circle, all of whom are billionaires, felt their assets, which they must hold abroad for safety purposes, if they felt their assets were threatened, this could be a danger for Putin. But so far, relatively few of his inner circle have actually suffered from this. The second part of the sanctions are prohibitions on the export of high-tech equipment, primarily oil technology, to Russia. The third one is the most interesting, and it's the one very few people understand. And it is that credit institutions, banks, insurance companies, etc., throughout the Western world are not allowed to make loans to Russia, to enterprise, to Russian companies that are on the sanctions list. They cannot make loans with a term of 1 year or more. Now, this doesn't sound very impressive, but this is the real bite of the sanctions on Russia. The reason for this is that one of the things the Russian economy failed to develop was a capital market. You therefore have the so-called national champions of Russia, the Rosneft, the Gazprom, etc., having to borrow money in Europe and the United States for investment capital. They have been borrowing for quite a while. The Western lending institutions have been willing lenders. They have become highly leveraged, so they have very high debts, some of which are coming due. Under normal circumstances, they would roll over these debts by additional lending. An example is the national oil company, Rosneft, which has an enormous debt burden, a lot of debt becoming maturing, and there's no place to go to get the money, other than to the Russian government, which has built up rainy day funds during periods of high energy prices. According to current Ministry of Finance estimates, the rainy day funds will be used up this year and the next. So there will be no rainy day funds in, say, late 2016. So one should not underestimate the power of these financial sanctions. One of the few weapons the United States still has at its disposal is a real control of the international financial system, because we are the international currency. We are the, trying to think of the term used, I can't think of it right now, but basically, U.S. banks and Treasury control the financial system of the world. If you do not believe me, look at how quickly Switzerland caved when the U.S. Treasury came to it and demanded that it disclose the names of Americans who had secret bank accounts in Switzerland. Another piece of evidence is the fact that China has recently reneged on a loan it was going to make to the Russian energy sector for fear that it might get into trouble with the U.S. Treasury. So these financial sanctions are the ones that really, really count. Let me see if I have a Can you show this? Here is Russia's foreign debt maturing within a year, and this is straight out of the Central Bank of Russia website. And it says that that's around $150 billion is due, and somehow the Russian companies, the Russian government, etc., must come up with this money simply to finance investment that has already taken place. You can contrast this with the international reserves of Russia, which is 350, so that's about 40% of total reserves. So you can drop this chart from the screen now. Hello, get rid of it. Thank you. Let's see if I have another. Okay, so what has Russia done? I can actually divide this into sort of different parts, and let's see how I organize this. I call this a double whammy, because the double whammy is the simultaneous collapse of oil prices plus being kicked out of world credit markets. So let's see how we can organize this. Let's begin with, being kicked out of the credit market, but let's look at the oil shock. So let's separate that out if we can. The oil shock is indeed a shock for the Russian economy. Although Putin promised early in his regime that he would make the Russian economy less dependent on oil, this has not happened. So if anything, the Russian economy is more dependent on oil. When he came in, around 42 or 43% of state revenue derived from energy. Now it's above 50%. So you can imagine what happens to a country's public finances if the source of income that accounts for 52% of its revenue is suddenly cut in half, because energy, oil prices have fallen by about a half. If you look at the export prices they're getting, and within a few months, this will hit the prices of natural gas, because the prices of natural gas are tied, are indexed to the price of oil some 6 months after the fact. So, problem number one, if you are Putin or Putin's minister of finance, is how are you going to make up for this loss? And I guess it's about a quarter of revenue. So I'll tell you exactly what they've been doing, because this is public information. The Ministry of Finance publishes this stuff. Here's how they've managed. They have taken some $50 billion from the Social Security Trust Fund lockbox. They actually have something similar to a lockbox, but the lockbox is now empty. So they've, let me give you another figure just to keep in mind. In order to keep investment constant, the Russian economy must raise something like $300 billion worth of investment finance. So if you think of filling in that hole, $50 billion from the trust fund lockbox fills 50 divided by 300. So it fills a good portion of it, but not very much. There are other things that they've done. I'm not going to go into the detail. But clearly, if you've lost this much revenue, you're going to have to engage in budget cuts. And the budget cuts have been very severe, with the exception of defense and propaganda. Putin spends an enormous amount on propaganda, almost as much as on education. So you can see for him, this is a huge priority for him. If you look at the actual budget cuts, they hit primarily public employees who are going to get no salary increases this year. They hit pensioners who are going to get a 5% increase, but I'm talking about nominal values. The inflation rate is predicted to be 12 to 14%. So if you are a public employee and your salary doesn't go up, your standard of living has gone down 12 to 14%. If you're a pensioner, your standard of living has gone down 6 or 7%. I emphasize this point because this is Putin's core constituency, public employees and pensioners. He sold himself to the Russian people, to the pensioners in particular, by saying, I'm going to pay your pensions on time. Yeltsin did not. I'm hence a better president. So the fact that he is basically abandoning this constituency must have been a bitter pill for him to swallow. Now, if we go back to this $300 billion figure, which is how much they have to raise in order to keep investment constant, so they've gotten some of it from the trust fund. They are now in the process of using up their rainy day funds accumulated during years of high oil prices. But still, they're falling short for some reasons associated with the sanctions. Because if you go back to a normal period, the Russian economy would receive about $50 billion a year in syndicated loans from Western credit markets, and they would receive $50 to $60 to $70 billion in foreign direct investment. That is now zero. So that's a loss of $120 billion right there, which doesn't cover much of the revenue taken out of the trust fund. I don't want to belabor this point other than to say, once you see figures like this, you understand the non-seriousness of the Russian claim that the sanctions are not hurting them. They're hurting very much, and they are causing some very tough decisions to be made. The second problem, again associated with, and this is directly associated with sanctions, is what to do about foreign exchange. Because you have these debts maturing, and I think it was $150 billion. You cannot borrow the money, so you have to somehow get foreign exchange. Where are you going to get it? The upper limit on what you can get is if all export earnings minus imports would equal a large sum of money, because that is your ultimate source of foreign exchange. When energy prices are falling, you're earning less foreign exchange. And even if all of that foreign exchange is brought back into Russia, you're still going to have significant shortfalls. To give you an example of this, I was reading, I think the Sunday New York Times, something about Riviera real estate. And Riviera real estate, French Riviera real estate, has fallen by 25%. It's fallen by 25% because the order has gone out to Putin's inner circle and colleagues that whatever they earn abroad can no longer be spent on London townhouses and French Riviera villas. It all has to come back. The recent rise in the Russian exchange rate, which they crow about as demonstrating the crisis is over, is largely a result of what we would call forced repatriation. That is, the word is out, Gazprom officials, you can no longer steal this money, you have to bring it back home. And that has worked, but there are limits on how far this can work. Now let me go to this, I think it'll be my final point, and this has to do with history repeating itself. So I'd like to go to a graph, and this is it, if you could show it. Can you see it? So, I would like you to look at the blue line, which is Russian GDP. I guess that chartreuse line is the price of oil, dollars per barrel. The green-like line is the exchange rate.
Is that right?
That's right.
That's the aqua line.
That's aqua? Okay. And then international reserves.
That's the yellow.
No, I have them mislabeled. That's the reason I was confused. The yellow line is international reserves. The aqua line is,
exchange rates, because look where exchange rates have gone.
The yellow is the exchange rate. And remember on this chart, when the exchange rate goes up, that's bad for Russia. The ruble is becoming less valuable. I would like you to look at, I assume this works.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's rubles per dollar.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Sorry.
Okay.
I apologize.
No, I can, it's my mistake. So, if you look at GDP, this is the financial crisis. Russian GDP declined by about 8%, which was a lot for the financial crisis. And you can see that the collapse of the energy price is what's causing this to happen. There's a slight lag. So the energy price falls first, and then it's followed by the GDP decline. The thing I want to emphasize is the rather short duration of the collapse of energy prices. So it's down, then it starts going back up. Imagine now if the price of energy had gone like that, say for 5 years. We don't know what would have happened. It didn't happen. But the fact that there was this very rapid recovery of the energy price, you can see is what made the decline in GDP management. Now, if we go to the sanctions period, and what I've put in, where you see those basically horizontal lines, I put in the estimates of the Ministry of Finance for what the exchange rate is going to be, what the price of oil is going to be, etc., and then projected GDP on the basis of those numbers. And I assume that the energy price is going to be low for about 2 years. And look what happens. You get basically that's probably about a 15 or 17% decline in GDP, which is a disastrous decline in GDP, and then you don't have a recovery. Now one can say, well, there were no sanctions during this period, but there are sanctions during this period. The two periods, however, are very similar, because as you may recall, during the financial crisis, there was a freezing of credit, and particularly a freezing of credit in the emerging markets. If you look at the syndicated loan market for Russia during this period, it went from like 60 billion ruble dollars to about 4 billion. So it was almost as if there were sanctions in place. So these two are quite similar in reality, only these were not sanctions, it was just a freezing up of the credit market. Now, if this type of analysis is correct, the Russian economy is in for very hard times. But this leaves, you can turn it off now. No, leave it on, because I have one other thing. Let's look at Venezuela. And I've learned by talking to colleagues that this is sort of a new area of growth theory and measurement of growth, because what I showed you earlier was conventional calculations of real GDP. So you take the prices of the country, you hold them fixed, and you look, and from this you try to figure out the increase or decrease in the real output of goods and services in the country's own prices. There's an alternate way of doing this, which is called purchasing power parity, where you try to figure out what you can actually buy with your income. And this is done largely on a on international comparison basis. You know about that, because these are 10 world tables. And something very interesting happens to the energy producing countries. Let's see what it is. The blue line is the purchasing power parity calculation. The whatever, what, chartreuse, or I don't know what that is. This is in national prices. This is Venezuela, and you can see that when you do it in purchasing power parity, the decline in output is much more pronounced. If you do this for Saudi Arabia, Saudi Arabia's GDP falls to about a half. So this is perhaps a way to capture the effect of energy prices on standards of living. And it's obvious, if you live in a country that's used to earning $200 billion from oil exports, and suddenly they only earn half that much, this is going to have an effect on the standard of living. So here's what the Russian numbers look like. So you can see what happens when energy prices are rising, and then the sharp decline. That decline is something like 17%. Of GDP, whereas the other one is like 8%. It turns out no one really knows how to interpret these things, so perhaps if I speak here again, I can give you a more definitive answer. If you can turn it off, I will conclude by saying that the sanctions matter. The Russian economy, unless the sanctions are removed, or unless the price of oil and gas miraculously recovers, is in for a very hard time. We do not know the effect that this economic catastrophe, if you want to call it that, will have on decision making within the Kremlin. Putin, I believe, is motivated not by economic factors, but by other factors. However, you cannot really ignore these things. An example being, when Crimea was annexed, the Russian pension system got all the Crimean pensioners, and about half of the Crimean population received pensions. This alone cut into cost of living increases in 2014, and Crimea is a tiny place. If you calculate what it would cost for the Russian budget to pay the pensions of the people of Donbass, Donetsk, and Luhansk, it's a huge sum of money. In the so-called volunteers fighting in East Ukraine from Russia are supposedly earning about $100 a day. That costs money. So even though you would like to ignore economics, you can't ignore economics completely. Let me stop there, because I think we could have perhaps an interesting conversation about some of the things I brought up. So I look forward to your comments.
All right, very, very interesting. Lead off. Introduce yourself so that Paul will know, and tell him where you're from.
Good evening. I'm Alexey Lin. I'm a Fulbright student from Russia, studying here at Bush School.
Let me start over.
All right, once again.
Is it
working?
Is it on?
No.
Not yet.
It worked for just a second.
Test.
Well, just
talk.
Go ahead and talk. Go. Yeah, now you're on.
All right. My name is Alexey Lin. I'm a Fulbright student from Russia, studying here at the Bush School of Government and Public Service. So thank you very much, Professor Gregory, for conducting this talk. And I would like to start with factual data, and then I'll go to my question. So
sure.
First of all, you mentioned that the annexation of Crimea was the first change of borders by military power. It was not the first one, in my opinion.
Kosovo.
Yes, Kosovo was the first one. Second were proclamation of independence of Abkhazia and South Ossetia in the same year, 2008. So Crimea was the third one. Second, you were speaking about that Russia will have somehow to pay off this, as you mentioned, $300 billion a year, right?
The $300 billion is the amount of investment in the Russian economy.
Yeah, my point is, it's not necessarily going to, because there is an option of imposing a moratorium on foreign debt payments. And actually, that was announced not by the government, but by the opposition, and in particular by an expert, economy expert, Vladislav Inozemtsev, who is in the opposition. But somehow, for some reason, the economy ministry denied this option. They said it's going to affect the reputation of Russia. But if the West imposes additional sanctions, I think Russia will be going. We'll have nothing to lose, so the investors probably are not going to get this money back. And now back to the question. I understood your central question in this presentation, but I didn't understand your central point. So you said that it's important to sort of sanctions from the impact of oil prices, and I think you mishear the third variable. In my opinion, it is Russian domestic economic politics, and I agree with you that this policy was quite ineffective in the last 15 years. So what I expected to hear from you, if we take the whole damage to Russian economy for 100, how much in percentage goes to a change in oil prices, how much does go to sanctions, and how much to Russia's own mistakes in domestic economic policy?
Yeah, no, these are good points. I need to learn more about Kosovo, because that is the usual counter-argument one hears if you claim this is the first change in international borders. It's argued Kosovo came earlier. I would love to answer the question, but I don't know much about Kosovo. Abkhazia are very much like Crimea, East Ukraine. You know, we can argue about it, but there was a war between Georgia and Russia There's a lot of dispute as to who started it, but clearly it was not in the Georgians' interest to be involved in a war against Russia. And Abkhazia became basically a frozen conflict. And have they had a referendum, and are they now part of appealing to become part of Russia? I don't know the latest. Abkhazia.
I'm not sure if Putin is going to accept them, just like the Donetsk and Lugansk republics. They also appealed. They also appealed for membership in the Russian Federation after the referendum, but Putin, in fact, didn't recognize them. His position is that we're not taking them.
Let me say that I believe it's clear Putin does not want the Donetsk People's Republic and does not want Luhansk People's Republic. He wants them to remain, what he says, a part of unitary Ukraine, but with veto power over major policy issues, which is unacceptable to the Ukrainians, which explains why a peaceful resolution at this point is not possible. As far as the toughest question of all, which is, you know, what percent is due to the oil price, what percent is due to the sanctions? I have a colleague who's tried to answer that question, really based upon looking at monetary statistics. Okay. And if you use simply the monetary statistics, where it's very hard to sort of wash out the effects of energy, he would be about 50-50 on this. But I don't have a scientific answer to your question. I think one can look at Iran, perhaps, and try to get an answer from Iran, because there you you don't necessarily have two or three things going on at once. Quickly on domestic policy, Putin was actually a fairly good president for about the first 4 or 5 years. He was following liberal policies. he then abandoned that policy. I can't give you the year, 2006, 2007, 2005, I don't know. And after that, it became clear there really weren't going to be further reforms, and therefore there weren't really good prospects for rapid growth after that. So that's the best I can do. Do we have other questions?
Dr. Gregory, thank you very much for coming. My name is Seth Dunbar. I'm a national security student here at the Bush School.
Are you an officer?
No.
You're not?
I'm not. Two questions for you, though. First, can you speak a little bit about the role of the Russian Central Bank in the economic crisis? They tried to raise rates in response to currency fluctuations earlier this year, and then ultimately ended up lowering them fairly shortly thereafter. And then two, you mentioned the impact of the sanctions on long-term funding. Dead after, I think it was a year.
Yeah.
Which makes sense because a lot of the industries you named are very capital intensive. But what about short-term overnight funding? That became such an issue here during the financial crisis. Are Russian firms as dependent on that as American firms are?
Tough questions. The Russian Central Bank did raise interest rates, I think, like to 16%, something like that, prevent a run on the ruble, because the one thing Russian citizens know is the exchange rate. Am I correct?
Right.
Because if you're in Moscow or anywhere in Russia, you walk down the street and every fifth store is an exchange store where you can exchange currency. And they'll put the exchange rate on a sort of like on a blackboard in front. So every Russian knows the exchange rate. And so Russians will key off the exchange rate to judge just how well things are going or how badly things are going. The Russian central, one way to prevent a run on the ruble is to offer very high interest rate. Because even though you're taking a risk that the ruble will further devalue, you're being rewarded with this extraordinarily high interest rate. So that, I think, you know, was not a bad move by the central bank. The central bank has subsequently lowered that interest rate 14%, something like that. Yeah, The central bank is doing a sleight of hand trick, however, and that sleight of hand trick is something called the repo market, which is supposed to be an overnight market, but in Russia it's something quite different. What the Russian central bank is doing is taking the debts of companies under attack like Rosneft, and they are buying these debts with their foreign exchange reserves. So the central bank is not intervening directly in the foreign exchange market. It's simply giving the Rosnefts and the Gazproms, etc., liquidity to meet these notes that are maturing. The Russian credit market is pretty miserable in all aspects, so I don't think they would have a very good overnight market.
What's going to happen, though, when that rainy day fund runs out?
The rainy day fund is really providing something like a quarter of investment finance right now. And so Putin is actually facing an interesting choice. Do you bail out your friends who own or manage Rosneft or Gazprom or Lukoil or whatever? Do you try to keep pensions increasing at the rate of inflation and so forth? The rainy day funds are being used up very quickly, and there's a long line of companies making claims on the rainy day fund. And I think it's very significant that public employees are going to experience a huge loss in their standard of living. And as I say, that's a core constituency. I hope I answered as best I could.
Stand up.
Well, no, this gentleman is getting the mic.
I'm sorry.
You're going to be next.
My first question kind of keys off of that.
Identify yourself.
Oh, I'm Philip Vetter. I've actually been applied mathematics, but I'm interested in geopolitical things. So a lot of regimes do not depend on the approval of the entire population, but just, you know, enough of the powerful. Will that work for Putin, and is that enough for him?
I would say it's very important to understand how Putin thinks about these things. And no one really can look inside his brain and understand how he thinks. What I do know is that he was very frightened by the so-called Euromaidan movement in Kiev, which actually overthrew a standing government, and a standing government of which he approved. And this occurred in February of 2014. In December of 2011, the Russian, at least the Moscow population, became quite incensed by the rigging of the parliamentary elections. And there were, for the first time, really big demonstrations in Moscow. There's a lot of dispute how many people, but you know, at least 50,000, maybe 70,000 were out on the streets. And at that time, Putin was in real danger. There was actually a quite negative sort of expose of Putin on national television, which portrayed him as a crook, and this was on national television. So I think at that time, this inner circle of the Kremlin, whatever that is, was seriously thinking about dumping him. So for him, the worst thing that could happen is people going out on the streets, demonstrating and overthrowing what he regarded as a legitimate government. I'm straying from your question, but perhaps by chance I've answered it. one often hears, well, he has an 85% approval rating. Any American politician would kill for that type of rating. We don't know the dynamics of that, because in Russia, if you ask people, name your five favorite politicians, they'd have trouble. Let me try as an experiment. Are you from Russia?
No, I'm from
Ukraine. Oh, well, we're going to hear perhaps a different story from you. You're from anyone else from Russia? Okay, name five Russian politicians.
I have trouble with that.
No, well, I've asked Ken. Either or.
What exactly politician? Any politician?
A political leader.
Proposing government.
It could be a member of parliament, could be a member of the cabinet, it could be the president, could be the prime minister. Name five.
Okay. You mean like top
no, this is five names. Five names.
Maybe the prime minister.
Okay, so you know who the prime minister is.
So one of them.
You know that Putin is the president.
You got two.
Finance minister.
Right. Okay, you know the finance minister. The defense minister. Ex-finance minister.
Yeah, anyway, he's a politician, I think.
Yeah, sure.
He can be considered.
Okay. But you're highly educated. If you go into a provincial town, would they have trouble naming five?
I don't know. It depends. I wouldn't say that.
Okay, the question public opinion surveyors ask is, what do you do about a country where the people really only know one name or two names? And I don't know the answer to that, but it's discussed. But he does have this very high popularity rating, which is very difficult to evaluate. If I could, is somebody up there? Because I have a little diagram on that.
We're going to have to take one more question.
Well, let's let our Ukrainian lady take it.
Maybe two more questions.
Okay. Is there somebody up there?
Yes.
Okay.
Put it up right
okay, this one.
There it is. Approval of Putin. Look at that. It's gone up.
Okay.
Now,
Putin begins. He's appointed prime minister by Yeltsin, who's very unpopular. Putin's popularity was around 27%. It shoots up. And why does it shoot up? The Chechen War. Yeah. There was massive outflow of patriotism. Putin is a hard guy. The Chechens are thugs. He's killing them. Everything's fine. And so the Chechen War got him up there. Then you have actually a pretty strong economy, which is helping. Then you get
the Olympics.
Well, the Olympics, I don't know. Here we have Georgia, 2008. And then we have Putin coming down. And what's this uptick here? Crimea and Ukraine. So, you know, what this suggests is when Putin's in trouble, it's a foreign adventure. And that's the way I read this. But we need to fit in two questions. Yeah.
Tatiana, tell them. She's one of my star students.
Okay.
Professor Gregory.
Where are you from?
I'm from Ukraine.
What city?
I was born in Odessa. It's in the south.
Yeah.
But I was educated and lived in Kyiv and worked there.
Where?
In Kyiv, in the capital. Yes. And
where did you go to school?
Diplomatic Academy of Ukraine.
Okay.
And here I studied international economics with concentration on refugee policy and management.
So with this